KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it too. We'll own it.
The implications of President Trump's idea for the people living in Gaza and for the region.
Today is Wednesday, February 5th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The former press secretary for Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky offers an idea for how to end the war in Ukraine.
It's always very difficult to be a first person to say what others think, but I believe that I did not talk for myself.
Also, does the Department of Homeland Security have enough staff to carry out President Trump's immigration policies?
There's not enough people to do the work that we're required to do by law and by public expectation.
And scientists rush to preserve data about gender and race that's being wiped from federal government websites.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Dearborn, Michigan is home to a large concentration of Arab and Muslim Americans. NPR's Don Gagne found both anger and strong criticism of President Trump's statement yesterday that the U.S. could take over Gaza while relocating its Palestinian population to some unnamed country.
Sam Ali is a business consultant in Dearborn, a third-generation Arab American. He sat out the 2024 presidential election in protest of the Biden administration's handling of the war in Gaza, but he is also very critical of Muslim Americans who decided the answer was to support Donald Trump.
They all got made fools of, all were given empty promises.
He said Trump's plans for Gaza would never have been fair or workable for the Palestinian people who call Gaza home. Others expressed concerns that Trump's proposal came with no consultation with those it will affect the most. Don Gagne, NPR News, Dearborn.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio is defending the dismantlement of the U.S. Agency for International Development, saying, quote, it did not have to be this way. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports aid officials and embassies around the globe will be sent home with some exceptions.
Rubio is on a swing through Central America, visiting embassies, including here in Guatemala, that have big USAID missions. One U.S. official tells me that it feels like they're preparing for an evacuation from a war zone, but where USAID staff are treated as aggressors. Rubio put the blame on the agency's officials in Washington, who he says weren't cooperating with his review.
Our preference would have been to do this in a more orderly fashion from the top down, but we had no cooperation and, in fact, insubordination, and so it required us to work from the bottom up.
Now, he says, his staff is reaching out to embassies around the globe to decide which projects and personnel are worth keeping. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Guatemala City.
350,000 Venezuelans are losing legal protections, allowing them to stay temporarily in the U.S. under a Trump administration rule. NPR's Greg Allen reports ending TPS for Venezuelans will have a large effect on Florida.
Large numbers of Venezuelans migrated to Florida in recent decades, fleeing the authoritarian regimes of Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro. Ending the program means that in 2 months, hundreds of thousands of them will face possible deportation. The news has sparked an outcry among Venezuelan Americans, many of whom supported Trump for president. Republican county commissioners in Miami-Dade are among those calling on the president to reverse his decision. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said he counts Venezuelan Americans among his supporters, but he's backing Trump.
So I think President Trump is getting the law right. He's going to get control over who is in this country.
DeSantis says he believes the Biden administration abused TPS in a way that encouraged more Venezuelans to come to the U.S. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
This is NPR. With the U.S. and China essentially at the beginning of what could be a lengthy trade fight, the initial victims are likely to be consumers. A new 10% tariff placed against Chinese goods coming into the U.S. and retaliatory tariffs from China are likely to push up the price of everything from toys to electronic devices to pots and pans. Some big-ticket items like appliances, furniture, and auto parts could also be affected. Tariffs on Chinese goods took effect after President Trump agreed to pause his threatened tariffs against Canada and Mexico. Scientists say they've temporarily reversed some symptoms of a paralyzing genetic disorder by stimulating nerves in the spine. NPR's John Hamilton reports on the study in the journal Nature Neuroscience.
Researchers at the University of Pittsburgh tried spinal stimulation on three people with spinal muscular atrophy, a rare inherited disorder that kills off many of the nerve cells that control muscles. During a month of daily stimulation, participants' leg muscles grew stronger and they were able to walk farther. Doug McCullough, who is 57, was one of the participants.
And after some days, my legs just felt supercharged. It's like, man, I feel like I can walk a mile.
Stimulation appears to work by restoring connections between the surviving motor neurons, which control muscles, and sensory neurons, which monitor what those muscles are doing. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices fell sharply today. That was as rising U.S. stockpiles, coupled with concerns over a new U.S.-China trade war, worried traders. Oil down more than 2% to end the session at $71.03 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. President Trump floated two stunning ideas about Gaza yesterday. The first is that he said the U.S. would take over the territory, which has been devastated by the recent war. And he said the entire population of Gaza would be relocated to other countries. Now, Trump offered no specifics for his plans, sending Palestinians and Israelis scrambling to understand what he means. From Tel Aviv, NPR's Daniel Estrin reports.
Audacity is what Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Trump celebrated at the White House. Netanyahu gave Trump a golden pager, commemorating Israel's exploding pager attack last year against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Then Trump floated his proposal to empty Gaza and take it over, and Netanyahu praised Trump.
You say things others refuse to say, and on after the jaws drop, people scratch their heads, and they say, you know, he's right.
Palestinian leaders and Saudi Arabia have rejected the removal of Palestinians from Gaza. Former Israeli officials are casting doubt on the viability of a U.S. takeover. Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert.
So on the day that I will see American soldiers coming in great numbers to Gaza, I will then make up my mind how serious it is. Right now, every party involved except for Israel is completely against it.
The U.S. is now involved in two Middle Eastern negotiations, one to get Hamas to give up its control of Gaza and release all Israeli hostages, and another to get Saudi Arabia to establish ties with Israel. Former Israeli Foreign Minister Shlomo Ben-Ami wonders if Trump could be employing a negotiating tactic.
Maybe this is a tactical sort of move that tries to say a big thing in order to eventually get a more modest solution.
Trump's endorsement of expelling Palestinians from their land helps Netanyahu stay in power and keep together his far-right allies, who have threatened to walk away because they want Israel to resume fighting in Gaza. Israeli columnist Nadav Eyal.
This is for Netanyahu like winning the lottery. First of all, because this is seen by the Israeli public as a major win politically, presenting an idea that was actually part of the Israeli right-wing fringe until a few years back, now as a plan by the great United States. Politically, this gives him oxygen to survive within his government.
Palestinian envoy to the United Nations, Riyad Mansour, said Palestinians want to rebuild Gaza after a devastating war, not abandon Gaza.
Because this is where they belong and they love to live there. Leaders and people should respect the wishes of the Palestinian people.
Trump said he wants to help Palestinians by sending Gaza's nearly 2 million residents to other countries.
It would be my hope that we could do something really nice, really good, where they wouldn't want to return. Why would they want to return? The place has been hell.
In Gaza City, which has been largely destroyed in the recent war, NPR producer Anas Baba asked young Palestinians what they want. Bassam Abdul Rauf, 29, said, even if there were a place a million times better than Gaza, even if life there would be luxurious, I would still live among the rubble and in tents here. I do not know how to describe what our love for Gaza means. Another man, 30-year-old Yahya Barakat, said he'd take Trump up on the offer. He said, my home is gone, my life is gone, my future is gone. If I find a country that provides me with safety and a good life, I will leave my homeland. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Last week, web pages and data across federal health agencies disappeared in response to executive orders from President Trump on issues like gender identity and diversity, equity, and inclusion. These now unavailable web pages covered a broad range of topics, from adolescent health to HIV to gender identity and racial equity. Now, many scientists across the U.S. are racing to preserve this data. Nancy Krieger is one of those scientists. She's a professor of social epidemiology at Harvard University and joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
I understand that last week you launched what's called a datathon in response to all of this federal health data disappearing from websites. What did that datathon entail exactly? Like, who was involved and what did you do?
So it was a group of us ad hoc that came together because we want to preserve public health data that are crucial for the people's well-being. Mm-hmm. And we were aware that environmental scientists had, since November especially, but before, cataloging and preserving big data sets that are relevant to understanding what's going on in the environment, including wildfire smoke and much else.
Absolutely.
But we were surprised by was the websites themselves coming down.
So how did you pinpoint the breadth of stuff that had suddenly disappeared and then find the original content? And then how did you preserve it?
So it's a work in process. We're very fortunate that there are tools available on the internet. One is called the Wayback Machine that actually just keeps preserving whatever happens to be on the web. And you can see when it was last on the web and when it disappears from the web. And we developed a list of search terms. Those search terms were based on what was in the range of executive orders that were issued since January 20th. They were based in part on a list that was shared of keywords that were being used at the CDC to search on data and to search on websites.
Okay, so give us one example that springs to mind of a web page or a data set that has disappeared from a government website that you are now trying to preserve because it is so crucial for the public to understand this data.
So one very vivid example, and I think it's really important to know that the executive order that's behind much of this takedown has as the first words defending women. Mm-hmm. So if one does a search and look for CDC gender-based violence, there was a page that used to exist that had the heading Ending Gender-Based Violence, Global Health, CDC. And this was dated November 18th, 2024, when that page was put up. And it said, adolescent girls and young women bear a disproportionate burden of HIV worldwide. This is driven by challenges like gender-based violence and difficulties accessing HIV services. If you search for that page now, the message you get is the page you're looking for was not found.
Wow. What is the loss, the cost to society when you lose access to information like this, at least ready access?
There are so many ways to reckon the cost, but I'll start with people's lives. I have no idea how many lives will be lost because of this, but I am sure that there will be excess mortality and excess suffering mentally and physically. And I think it's another important point to make is that for all the critique that's being made of the concerns about inclusivity, inclusivity increased who was represented and visible in the data, never took anybody away. These steps are censorship. It's effectively a digital book burning. Reality doesn't disappear because these data are no longer accessible.
Absolutely. Are you personally worried that there could be legal or professional consequences to you personally for pushing this effort at preserving the data?
I am an academic. I teach. This is protected activity. And in terms of whether this means I could be singled out, I don't know. I mean, my own research focuses fundamentally on health equity, and those are topics that are up for grabs right now in terms of what's going to be funded or not. But that's not me individually. That's an entire field. I think what is so striking, I was asked by one person, how does this differ from when he came in the first time? Was there similar attempts to take this material down on the websites? And frankly, there was much less of this on the websites because the work was just being done. Mm-hmm. And the events, particularly around the racism in health, were impelled by all this social movement change that happened in the aftermath of the onset of the COVID pandemic, what incredible inequities that revealed instantly, combined with the police murder of George Floyd in 2020 also, led to the reckonings in many scientific institutions, not just the NIH and CDC, to start addressing the impacts of racism on health.
Nancy Krieger is a professor of social epidemiology at Harvard University. Thank you very much for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Colonel Harry Stewart Jr., one of the last surviving members of the Tuskegee Airmen, died this week. He was 100 years old. The Tuskegee Airmen were a predominantly black unit of Army pilots that fought during World War II.
Stewart says he had a love of planes from when he was young, when his parents lived near an Army airfield.
My parents used to put me out in the crib in the daytime to sun me, and they told me that when the planes would fly over, I would look up and Google at the planes and coo along, that type of thing.
That's from an interview with Michigan Public back in 2019.
But Stewart, who grew up in New York, says he confronted the realities of Jim Crow as he was taking the train to Mississippi for basic training.
When we got to Washington, the conductor came into the car that I was in, and I happened to be with some kids from my neighborhood at the time. They were white, and the conductor pointed to me, and he said, you go up to the Jim Crow car in the front.
Stewart flew more than 40 combat missions during World War II.
Despite the experience, Stewart says, when he got back to the U.S., no commercial airline would hire him to be a pilot. So he switched careers, eventually becoming an engineer.
But he and other Tuskegee Airmen eventually got recognition for their achievement. President George W. Bush honored them with a Congressional Gold Medal in 2007.
And he says, I even understand that, you know, even you as officers had terrible events where you were not even saluted at times by the white soldiers there. And he says, but I want to make amends as far as that's concerned. And he stood back and drew himself up to full attention and threw up his right arm and saluted the group.
Lieutenant Colonel Stewart told Michigan Public that the name of his aircraft was Little Coquette, named after one of his favorite songs.
I didn't have a girlfriend at the time, so when it came to putting the nose art on my aircraft there, I decided to go ahead and have them put Little Coquette.
That was Lieutenant Colonel Harry Stewart Jr. He died this week at the age of 100.
Tell me why you keep pulling little...
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ailsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. What if the only way Ukraine can win its war against Russia is to stop fighting? Well, that's a controversial question, especially inside Ukraine, which has not stopped our next guest, who is in Ukraine, from asking it. Yulia Mindel had a front row seat to the run-up to the war. She was President Zelensky's press secretary from 2019 to 2021. She has since left the government, and she has written a piece now for Time magazine headlined, "Ukraine Needs a Ceasefire Now." Yulia Mindel's on the line from Kyiv. Hi there.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So, in a sentence or two, what exactly are you arguing for? That this is a peace deal that would not be a surrender to Russia, but would involve territorial concessions?
I'm not a politician, I'm a journalist. And my call was to find the right diagnosis of what's happening today in Ukraine. I see that we are losing people in so many ways. This war turned so many territories of Ukraine into hell, literally hell.
Yeah.
And economic, demographic, and different other signs show that the only way to survive in this war is actually to make a pause in the war of attrition.
You know, when I have reported from Ukraine, when I have reported about Ukraine these last several years, I keep meeting people, Ukrainians, who argue Ukraine must fight, Ukraine must win, must not cede one single inch of Ukrainian soil to Russia, whatever the cost. At the beginning of the war, is that how you thought about things? Is that where you were?
Definitely in 2022, there was existential threat. There were hundreds of thousand men who returned to the country with closed borders to defend the country. Everyone here was inspired to stand for our identity. But it was 2022, and I'm afraid what we are talking now is really a little bit far from the reality, and it's really very different in 2025.
What about the argument, Yulia Mindel, that a ceasefire, any kind of peace deal, wouldn't really end this? It would just allow Vladimir Putin to go home, rebuild his army, come back, attack Ukraine again.
If we have a ceasefire, we can build fortifications that we had not built before the war. We can rest, we can restore our economy, we can open the borders, we can restore democracy that has been also suffering during this time, and we can restore the trust of the people whom we are actually losing in liberated even territories. If we become stronger, then we can stand against Russia. If we are exhausted every moment here, we will not be able to stand in a year or 2 years.
When you float this idea to your fellow Ukrainians, what do they say?
I was criticized by many people, but in fact, I've got much more thank you from around Ukraine. It's always very difficult to be a first person to say what others think, but I believe that I did not talk for myself. I believe that I talked for the people from Kherson, Zaporizhia, Kharkiv, Donetsk, Luhansk, Dnipropetrovsk, Chernihiv, Sumy, and many, many other Ukrainian regions where people are desperately looking for any kind of ceasefire.
Hmm. Before I let you go, the last time that you and I spoke, you were telling me about your family village near Kherson in southern Ukraine, about your childhood there and about eating apricots and cherries. What is left of your village?
Nothing. It's just the ruins. And Russians control there with drones. So there are almost no people. People cannot drive there anymore because Russian drones are making safari and they are hunting people there. It's not livable right now, unfortunately, but thank you for asking. And that's what I mean. You know, we are talking brave, but I think it's much braver to realize our weaknesses and to tell the world that we want to be strong in leadership. And strong leadership means to take care about the people and to find the solutions to preserve the country. Mm.
You're reminding me something else of what you told me when you and I spoke a couple of years ago. You said, we are fighters, Ukrainians, and you called on the world to stand shoulder to shoulder with Ukraine until this war was over. What would your message be today to Americans listening?
Ukraine would not exist if Americans did not stand with us. And thanks to this, we stand today as an independent country. I ask you to understand that if you want us to be the independent country, if you want Putin not to come to Kyiv in a year or a year and a half, help us develop this process to a peace that would be just, but also will help us survive as the nation.
That is Yulia Mendel, former press secretary to Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky. Her book about Ukraine is titled The Fight of Our Lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Waffle House restaurants are now charging an extra 50 cents for every egg they sell. That's a lot of eggs, over 2,000 locations in 25 states. Marlon Hyde from member station WABE reports that the Georgia-based chain plans to change the extra egg fee as they monitor prices.
Darlene McCory pulls up to an Atlanta Waffle House after working a late shift. She notices a bright yellow and red poster in the window that says 50 cents per egg.
So I'm about to order an extra egg now, so I know I got to pay the extra, 50 cents? Yeah.
She says the surcharge will not stop her from getting her signature All-Star Special. That comes with eggs, a waffle, and a variety of sides.
We all love Waffle House, so we can't really change what's going on.
What's going on is that Waffle House says that an unprecedented rise in egg prices is forcing the surcharge on its most popular item, one that Waffle House regular Halo Harris may be skipping for a while.
Yeah, I saw that on the news this morning. I'm not finna buy it. I'm gonna get me some grits and sausage and keep it pushing.
So you're skipping the eggs, but you're not skipping Waffle House?
Waffle House serves approximately 272 million eggs a year, according to its website. Sina Golar is a business professor at Georgia State University. He says it was a good idea for Waffle House to focus only on raising egg prices.
This will actually have the effect of pushing customers to order items that don't have eggs. So it might actually help balance demand a little bit and move pressure out of eggs and onto some other items.
The American Egg Board says 50 million laying hens were lost to bird flu in the past year, while the demand for eggs went up. Golara says the future of egg prices is not yet clear.
Very hard to tell because a lot of it also depends on the virus progress itself.
This current bird flu outbreak has been around since 2022 and tends to increase in winter months, Golara says. As the weather warms and the virus gets weaker, he expects prices could come down again. But until then, small business owners like Karima Goodman have to decide whether to pass on the cost to customers. She runs Sweet Brown Sugar Bakery in an Atlanta suburb.
As a business owner, you have to take the hit on the eggs, especially when eggs make up 90% of the ingredients in the bakery.
With prices still rising, some grocery stores are running out of eggs. Others are limiting the number of eggs people can buy. For NPR News, I'm Marlon Hyde in Atlanta.
It's NPR News.
President Trump has talked about buying or taking Greenland. Not a new thing, because the U.S. has taken advantage of the Danish territory before. You see, during the Cold War, an underground military base was built without Denmark's permission.
It was cold. You know, when you walk down there, you know, like walking into a freezer.
America's history with Greenland on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, bird flu is killing off a lot of wildlife, not just dairy, cows, and poultry.
Scientists are reporting deaths in sea mammals and wild birds.
It was just like birds flying, you know, falling out of the sky dead. So, yeah. I mean, it is very dramatic. It is very dramatic.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Left-leaning groups that were critical of the Biden-Harris administration's policy on the Israeli-Hamas war are now responding to President Trump's pledge for the U.S. to take control over Gaza. NPR's Elena Moore says despite not supporting Harris last fall, some are rebuking Trump's comments.
In a statement from the Abandon Harris movement, leaders both called Trump's comments grotesque and stood by their criticism of Democrats, saying they refused to equate, quote, Trump's inflammatory rhetoric with the Biden-Harris administration's concrete actions. They called the election a, quote, choice between two monstrous evils. The Muslim advocacy group Care Action also characterized Trump's comments as inhumane and dangerously irresponsible. The group promoted third-party candidates over Harris last fall. Trump's comments come after he courted Muslim voters in the election, and exit polling indicates Democrats lost serious ground with this group. Elena Moore, NPR News.
The Senate has confirmed former NFL player Texas lawmaker Scott Turner to lead the Department of Housing and Urban Development. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports Turner has said he'll review all of HUD's programs.
At his confirmation hearing last month, Turner said HUD is failing at its most basic mission, citing record-high homelessness and a lack of affordable housing. He offered few specifics to fix that, but said the agency needs to streamline programs. He also declined to say whether he'd object to major funding cuts for HUD. That's something Trump tried repeatedly in his first term. Turner said the high cost of building materials is a big problem, but did not weigh in on Trump's proposal to impose tariffs on Mexico and Canada. Last week, the National Association of Home Builders asked for an exemption from such tariffs, noting they would drive up home prices.
That's Jennifer Ludden. This is NPR. The National Women's Soccer League has agreed to a $5 million settlement over an abuse scandal that erupted in 2021. That's when players accused coaches of sexual coercion and other mistreatment. NPR's Becky Sullivan has the story.
In 2021, the NWSL was roiled by a flood of abuse allegations about coaches who sexually harassed players or subjected them to racism and verbal abuse. League officials and head coaches resigned or were fired. Two major investigations, one by the league and its players union, and another by a former deputy U.S. attorney general, substantiated the claims and concluded the problems were systemic across the league. Afterward, attorneys general from two states in the District of Columbia opened their own inquiry. Now they've announced a settlement. The league will set aside $5 million for victims and implement other reforms, including regular anonymous surveys of players that will be reported back to prosecutors. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
More nonprofit groups have filed lawsuits against the Trump administration's efforts to freeze trillions of dollars in federal funding. A judge ruled yesterday to allow the suits to move forward and extended a temporary restraining order blocking the Trump administration. The president of Democracy Forward, which brought the lawsuit, says she expects an avalanche of litigation to put a stop to the unlawful activity. Well, stocks finished higher today on Wall Street as the focus swung back to quarterly company profits this week. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump came into office with big plans for immigration policy. Already, he's directing the Homeland Security Department and other agencies to arrest and deport more people. But while he has large expectations, the government may not have enough people to do the job. NPR immigration policy reporter Ximena Bustillo has been digging into this and joins us now. Hi, Ximena.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so I understand that you ran the numbers on how big the Department of Homeland Security actually is. What did you find?
The Homeland Security Department encompasses some 230,000 people and is home to three agencies: Customs and Border Protection, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service. These are the ones that specifically handle immigration.
Right.
And these include guarding border checkpoints, processing visas and asylum claims, and processing deportations. At the end of last year, I asked each one to tell me how many employees they had by the end of the last three presidents, to see at least in recent history what each previous president was handing the next.
And what did the numbers show?
Well, in total, the workforce grew by about a fifth across all of DHS compared to when Trump started as president in 2017. The data showed that two agencies, Customs and Border Protection and Citizenship and Immigration Service, had a steady increase in hiring under Trump and then again under Biden. Now, ICE was the only agency to see a decrease, but not by much. By the end of 4 years of Biden, they seem to have lost 72 employees on paper. And ICE is the smallest of the three, and end of your reports say that it has had a steady staffing level for decades across different presidencies.
Okay, so generally speaking, it sounds like Trump is getting more people and didn't necessarily lose many within ICE, but I know that your reporting shows the agency still has staffing problems that aren't going away anytime soon, right?
Right. So even though two of the agencies, CBP and USCIS, saw an increase in staffing levels, mm-hmm. the workload has also increased with time. The Biden administration tried to spur hiring through things like hiring bonuses, but it didn't always help. CBP, for example, has not been able to hire enough Border Patrol agents to meet staffing targets in recent fiscal years, and that's according to a recent government accountability report. Much of this is also not new. DHS union leaders told me that staffing issues have been a long-time problem. Here's Michael Knowles, who since 2000 has been a local president for one of the unions representing employees of Citizenship and Immigration Services.
There's not enough people to do the work that we're required to do by law and by public expectation.
Wait, say more about that. Like, what's changed so far in this administration that would increase public expectation on the staff at DHS?
Quite a bit. The White House has placed quotas on ICE field offices to arrest a minimum of 75 people per day suspected of being in the country without authorization. Trump also signed into law the Laken Riley Act, which could make more people easier to deport. The White House has, in a way, addressed the limits. Officials, including new Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, have told reporters that they need congressional help to provide funding for more staff. They're also expanding the FBI, U.S. Marshals, and the military's role in immigration enforcement. But I talked with Jason Hauser, a chief of staff for ICE under Biden, and he says no political party, including Democrats, have figured out how to manage the full demands of the immigration processing supply chain.
Yes, you can create more security at the border, more staffing, etc. That's going to increase encounters. When you increase encounters, you need more ICE staff, you need more USCIS staff, you need more Department of Justice staff.
That is NPR's Ximena Bustillo. Thank you, Ximena.
Thank you.
An unprecedented number of people in the U.S. were infected with bird flu this past year. In this country, a lot of science focused on the virus in dairy cows and in poultry, but researchers say something ominous is happening in wild animals and not just birds. NPR's Gabriella Emanuel reports.
Last year, Marcela Uhart was walking on a beach in Argentina. The Punta Delgada, travel guides boast of its rich marine wildlife. But the scene that she saw was not idyllic. It was a horror scene.
The beaches were just loaded with carcasses. We estimate about 18,000 dead baby elephant seals.
Dead from bird flu. Uhart is a researcher. She studies wildlife health at the University of California, Davis. She came to this beach because she's been tracking bird flu as it goes from one bird species to another, pelicans to terns to other seabirds, and then spills over into marine life and then back to birds. When Uhart was standing on that beach, she says she could see birds stumbling around, having seizures on the sand. As she looked up,
it was just like birds flying, you know, falling out of the sky dead. So, yeah, I mean, it is very dramatic. It is very dramatic.
Dramatic and worrisome, because what she saw was evidence that this very deadly virus had found a way to travel and fast.
It's like wildfire. I mean, it just killed everything it encountered. We were all skeptical that this could be possible, but then somehow this started happening with this virus.
Now, this virus, H5N1, it's been around for decades. It originated in East Asia, infecting poultry and sometimes people, and it did periodically jump over into wild birds. But the virus killed them quickly before they could migrate, so the virus never took off globally. Then, about 5 years ago, the virus changed. Eric Carlson is the director of the Cambodian National Influenza Center.
This new virus seems to be a bit more like dead bird flying, right?
So a bird gets infected and will likely die eventually. But first,
they seem to be able to still migrate further, and they contact another group of birds. They fly a little bit further, and that eventually gets all the way across the world.
It's almost like a relay race, and that's what Michelle Villa has been mapping. She's at the Center for Pathogen Genomics at the University of Melbourne. She says infected wild birds carried the virus to North America a few years ago, and then South America.
So then in South America, it traveled the 6,000-kilometer spine in about 6 months, okay? So this is a virus that's not assisted by airplanes. This is a virus that's traveling by mass mortality after mass mortality after mass mortality after mass mortality.
Now, she says, the virus is racing around Antarctica. The problem globally is nobody knows how many wild animals the virus has killed.
No one's counting. We have no idea. So it's been like a catastrophe. It is a global catastrophe.
It's a catastrophe for the animal species and for the ecosystems they're part of. But on top of that, this matters for human health. People can get bird flu, but right now, the virus doesn't spread easily from one person to another. That could change. The estimates are millions of birds have been infected and tens of thousands of marine mammals. And each animal the virus infects, that's another chance for it to evolve. Flu viruses, including bird flu, are known for lots of genetic changes.
So as they've gone to new places, they've mixed and matched their genes with one of their normal influences. The resulting virus could be sort of Frankenstein of those two things.
Scientists say this makes it particularly important for people to know what's happening in the animal world. That way, we can know what the virus might do in the human world next. Gabriela Emanuel, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Marco Rubio's inaugural overseas trip as U.S. Secretary of State has been somewhat overshadowed by the fallout over the dismantling of the U.S. Agency for International Development. Rubio is currently at the end of a five-country sweep through Central America. Today, he is in Guatemala, and NPR State Department correspondent Michelle Kellerman is traveling with him. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Michelle, there's a lot to unpack here. Let's start with this. Secretary Rubio held a press conference this afternoon in Guatemala with the president there. What came up?
Yeah, I mean, President Bernardo Arevalo says he agreed to increase by 40% the deportation flights from the U.S. You know, Guatemala has been accepting back those Guatemalans who are in the U.S. illegally and being deported back home. And Rubio praised Guatemala for the way that they're reintegrating these deportees. He also announced some plans in the works to build infrastructure in Guatemala to start looking at building a couple of ports and some roads. So migration and trade were really the central themes here. And by the way, Rubio called it an impactful visit, and he joked that there was a sign of just how impactful. There was an earthquake overnight that woke him up, and he said that he had actually never experienced one before.
Okay, I want to turn to a different topic because the news about USAID has been a big issue here in the States, but I'm curious what you've been hearing from the people that you've been meeting in the region. What have they had to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, there was a statement last night that said they're all going to be put on leave Friday and they have to be gone in 30 days. And USAID officials are really shell-shocked by that. I mean, one U.S. official told me that it feels like there's an evacuation from a war zone underway, but USAID staff are being treated as the aggressors. There are about 200 USAID staffers at the embassy here in Guatemala. Most of them are locally hired employees, so Guatemalans who, you know, oversee the aid programs here. There are also some Foreign Service officers, and they really don't know what's in store for them. Rubio said that there will be exceptions for programs that are in the national interests. And, you know, he said it was USAID's fault that it had to be done this way. Take a listen to how he put it.
On USAID, unfortunately, we did not get the same level of cooperation. In fact, we had individuals, even after the orders were issued, that were still trying to push payments through in contravention and in direct insubordination. And so now we've had to do it in the opposite direction. It's not the way we wanted to do it initially, but it is the way we will have to do it now.
This is Secretary Rubio's first overseas trip, five countries in total. Take stock of the trip in whole. What do you think he's achieved with it?
Well, I mean, his whole message is that this is a sign that American leadership in the hemisphere is back, that this region has been ignored too long and will get more attention. Migration, as I said, was really key. He went to see a flight of migrants being deported from Panama to Colombia. Those are people who were stopped in Panama before they could make their way to the U.S. Here in Guatemala, he's going to be talking to local authorities who are cooperating with ICE on those Guatemalans deported from the U.S. And in El Salvador, he talked about the president's offer to take back migrant gang members and criminals. The El Salvadoran president even suggested that the U.S. could send U.S. citizens who are criminals to outsource, you know, jails to El Salvador. The other big issue, of course, was the Panama Canal. He was, that's where he started, in Panama. And President Trump wants the Panama Canal back. Rubio said he raised some concerns about the Panama Canal with Panama's president. But Panama's president says, you know, control over the canal is not up for discussion.
That is NPR's Michelle Kellerman traveling with Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Michelle, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. In Colombia, President Gustavo Petro has promised to disarm the country's guerrilla groups through peace talks. But there's been almost no progress, and a fierce outbreak of fighting has forced tens of thousands of Colombians from their homes. John Otis reports, and a warning to listeners, you will hear gunfire in this story.
The fighting began last month in Catatumbo, a remote area in northern Colombia that borders Venezuela. In this video obtained by NPR, guerrillas of the National Liberation Army, or ELN, are battling a rival rebel faction for control over fields of coca, the raw material for cocaine. Authorities say more than 40 people have been killed.
The ELN entered different communities across Catatumbo with a list of names.
Elizabeth Dickinson, who tracks Colombia for the International Crisis Group, says many were civilians executed for allegedly collaborating with the ELN's enemies.
They went house to house looking for these individuals, took them to the street, in many cases assassinated them in front of their families.
Amid the panic, 50,000 people have fled their homes. Some have crowded into this elementary school that's been converted into a shelter in the town of Tibú.
Kids are playing basketball. Some of the adults are washing their clothes. Others are just resting on mattresses laid out on the gym floor.
They include Bernabe Polo, a coal miner who, along with his wife and two children, fled to avoid getting hit by stray bullets.
Y cerquita, o sea, del lugar donde estábamos. Toditos al suelo, al piso, ahí nos mantuvimos en toda la noche.
The fighting was really close to our house, he says. We threw ourselves on the floor and stayed there all night. Police and army troops are now patrolling Catatumbo, but this region has long been a stronghold of ELN guerrillas. The group first rose up as a Marxist insurgency in the 1960s, but these days it mainly extorts businesses and traffics cocaine. That disgusts Colombian President Gustavo Petro, who is himself a former guerrilla fighter but disarmed 35 years ago.
Carlos Marx, en el cual dicen que creen.
During a recent visit to Catatumbo, he said that the ELN claims to follow Karl Marx, but it seems to me they believe more in Pablo Escobar. Indeed, drug trafficking helps explain why, after more than 60 years of armed conflict, peace continues to elude Colombia. The violence briefly diminished after the country's largest guerrilla group, known as the FARC, disarmed in 2016. But the government failed to take control of coca fields and drug trafficking routes that were abandoned by the FARC. And now, ELN rebels and a new generation of criminal groups are fighting over this territory. When he took office in 2022, Petro immediately opened talks with the ELN and other rebel factions to secure what he called total peace for Colombia.
Initially, the government gave up way too much in these talks.
But Dickinson of the International Crisis Group says Petro agreed to multiple ceasefires that hamstrung the army while giving the guerrillas time to regroup.
A lot of frustration inside the ranks of the military that they were being had their hands tied and are now being sent to sort of clean up the mess.
Now, the ELN peace talks have been suspended, and government troops are preparing to attack them. But the rebels can escape into Venezuela, which lies just a few miles from here. In fact, analysts say half of the ELN's 6,000 rebels live and train in Venezuela. In the meantime, families keep pouring into the shelters. Some of the displaced, like Victor Lopez and his pregnant wife, are Venezuelan migrants. They crossed the border 4 months ago to escape Venezuela's economic crisis. But now, Lopez laments, they've been forced to flee once again, this time by Colombia's guerrilla war. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Tibú, Colombia.
This week, the bidding begins for a very pricey Stradivarius violin heard here in a video from Sotheby's. The auction house estimates the instrument could fetch anywhere from $12 to $18 million. And if it hits the higher end of that range, it could break the record for the priciest musical instrument ever sold at auction.
And if you're wondering, the current record is held by another Strad, sold for nearly $16 million in 2011. These violins are among the most coveted in the world, and there's a good reason for that.
A Stradivari, it's like being a painter and having access to thousands of colors to paint from rather than dozens of colors.
Violinist Joshua Bell spoke with NPR's James Dubek this week.
Dozens of colors is probably enough for, you know, general playing, but when you start acquiring a need for sound, I use the word colors, but sound colors that are more and more subtle, the Stradivari offers you that.
Back in 2016, Bell performed a tiny desk concert with his very own Stradivarius with Jeremy Dink on piano.
There is a reason why the Stradivarius are in demand by violin soloists, et cetera, that it's not just for the name. It's something very, very special that it does to the player. That special Stradivari sound, the overtones that just give you goosebumps when you play on it.
We can thank Antonio Stradivari for those goosebumps. Sotheby's says the Italian craftsman made the violin up for auction in the year 1714, during his so-called golden period. And it's been owned by several virtuosos through the centuries.
But Bell did point out that Strad violins are not entirely superior to modern ones. For one, modern violins, they're a lot easier to play.
A Strad, you have to coax out. You could easily make a nasty sound or a crunchy sound, or if you don't move your bow at exactly the right speed, it can whistle or squeak, or, you know, so you really have to get to know the instrument and know how to use it.
Bell says there are hundreds of these prized instruments left today, but only a fraction of them could fetch anywhere near $18 million.
So $18 million is kind of a bargain. I'm biased as well.
Well, I'll start looking under the couch cushions, I guess, Juana.
You better keep looking, but you've still got a couple of days because the bidding kicks off on Friday.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. From Dignity Memorial, helping families today to protect their loved ones tomorrow. Planning celebrations of life in advance can give families peace of mind. Learn more at dignitymemorial.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research.
Come on in. Come on along, let me take you by the hand up to the man,